From NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras.
And I'm Jasmine Garst. You're hearing something new from Bajo Fondo. This is the song Pide Piso. And we have a very special guest today. Basically, if you listen to Alt Latino regularly, Gustavo Santaolalla has produced pretty much every band you love on this show.
And as a youngster, I was very fond of reading liner notes, and I still am. And I discovered early on that Gustavo Santaolalla is a name that was on a lot of my favorite records from the early 90s and then just kept producing great music. Gustavo's joining us from NPR West in Culver City. Gustavo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, guys. I'm very happy to be here.
Gustavo, it took us forever to get you on the show. We've been trying since two
really?
Years ago when the show started.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, this is the first time that really this news came to me.
Te hace rogar, eh?
No, not really. Not really. I didn't know. So now that I know, I'm here.
Great.
I will say, when we announced that you were going to be on the show, our listeners went crazy. We have never gotten so many emails for like listener questions. We have a lot of questions for you, and I understand you also brought some pretty amazing new music.
I brought a whole bunch of music and interesting stuff, and perhaps stuff that people, you know, haven't heard, you know, that I've been involved, or friends of mine have been involved.
want to start you, let's go a little back in time and start at the beginning. What was playing around your house when you were growing up?
Okay, my parents were very, very musical. Not that any of them play an instrument, but they love music and they were avid record buyers. So I grew up listening to all kinds of music. I think that's part of my the way I was formed musically. So at home we'll listen from Argentinian traditional music, you know, folk music or tango. But also at the same time we listen a lot of, you know, American music. I mean, from Les Paul and Mary Ford to, you know, I mean, really Frankie Lane. I mean, really, I mean, old stuff, you know. And I'm talking about when I was really, really, really young. And also classical music and orchestral music. So it was quite a variety of music that I listened to. And I remember there was a song, there's a funny thing about it, because there was a song that in Spanish was called Tirando Manteca al Techo, which the translation would be like throwing butter to the roof, right? So I never knew what the song was called in English, but the melody went something like ta-da-da-da, 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 ta-da-da-da. It was in a foxtrot mood, you know. Uh-huh. I learned then this much later in my life that the song originally was in a much slower, sensuous mood. But really, and I was 3 years old, and my parents would put that record, I would go nuts dancing, you know. And later I found out that the song was Making Whoopee. That's the song that ta-da-da-da. They're making whoopee. But the version that I had was
they were making whoopee faster.
Yeah. I mean, it was in media. My parents, they were die laughing. They would put the record and I just would go automatically into, you know, dancing mode. So it was great. I mean, it was very, very mixed selection of music that I grew up sounding around me, you know.
And did you want to be a musician when you were growing up?
Well, I started playing guitar when I was 5 years old. My grandmother gave me a guitar as a present. My mother was a sort of guitar player, not frustrated guitar player. She never actually even got a guitar, but she always dreamt about playing the guitar, that, you know, she would have loved when she was a kid to learn guitar and stuff. So somehow I think, you know, she passed that on to me. And I started when I was five, sort of studying with a professor. By the time I was 10, you know, we really didn't get along. I mean, I never really mastered the academic side of music. And up to this day, I don't know how to read or write music. But, you know, I learned all my, I guess, my playing skills since that early age. So by the time I was 10, the teacher was so frustrated, you know, I came to my mother and said, his ear is stronger than my music. I quit. And she quit.
Wow.
I was 10 then, and it's exactly when I started writing my own stuff. So I started writing my first thing when I was 10, 11 years old. So by the time I was 12, I wrote a really, really kind of like a more serious form, you know, song. And then from then on, I just didn't stop, you know. So by the time I was 13, the Beatles came to life, and that was it. I knew when I saw them and when I heard them that's what I wanted to do with my life.
And you started out in a band so young, the band Arcoiris, which is the pioneer in the fusion of Latin American folk and rock and mm-hmm. what we call in Argentina rock nacional. Mm-hmm. It's so, so young. We have a listener from Argentina who wrote to us. Her name is Susana Pagliaminuta. And she says she just grew up loving that band.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, you know, I mean, we were very, very young. I mean, we had the band really, you know, playing together since we were like 13, the same band. By the time we were 16, I signed my first record deal, and I started my career officially as an artist and as a producer, because there were such a thing as alternative music producers. I don't even think the word alternative was coined then. So I was always a big fan, not only of the artist and the songs, but I always looked, you know, on the other side of the cover and right. said, you know, produced by George Martin.
Right. Or
I will look at the Kinks and will say produced by Shel Talmy or you know, The Who, Kid Lambert. And, you know, and I started to learn what was the role of those guys in the studio, and I became fascinated with it, not only with the art of writing a song or arranging or performing a song, but the art of turning that into a record, the art of making records. And so that's why I've always been so attracted to the production side also of music, you know. And so I started officially as a as an artist and as a producer when I was 16, and I signed with RCA, with Arco Iris.
Nice. Let's go back in time and hear a cut from Arco Iris right now.
And you know, when people think of Arco Iris, the first song that comes to mind is Mañana Campestre.
Correct.
Do you want to play that, or is there something?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh,
you can play that. That's no problem. You know, you can play. The nice thing about Mañana Campestre is that has become what I think every songwriter aspires of a song. It doesn't belong to me anymore, you know what I mean? It's a song that is so popular in Argentina. They teach the song in schools, and you know, any cab driver will sing the song, and lots of them don't even know that it is a Gustavo Santaolalla song, or some of them, or kids, don't even know that it's an Arco Iris song. It's just part of the national repertoire, you know?
I remember learning Mañana Campestre in Argentine public school.
So I love what happened with that song.
So all of this development is Arco Iris happened with the backdrop of the Argentine dictatorship.
And, correct.
And I remember an anecdote that my Spanish literature teacher in Argentina used to tell us about how kind of in the late 70s, she used to be a big AC/DC fan. Mm-hmm. And there was this environment, this heavily repressive environment, and she would bring back the new AC/DC record to her house, go to her basement with her neighborhood friends, and they would play it really, really low so that, you know, it wouldn't, you know, the neighbors yeah. wouldn't hear. And, you know, yeah. it's kind of interesting because you're supposed to hear AC/DC
very loud.
Very yeah. loud. And they were listening to it really low. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, what was the musical environment like at that time, and how did that permeate you as an artist?
Well, I, you know, started, you know, to deal with the political situation in Argentina since a very, very early age, and we there kind of become, because of the reality, more, you know, aware of what's going on political since a very early age. So by the time I was 16, 17, I started growing my hair. I started to be put in jail many times. I've been in jail in Argentina between, I say, 16 to 24 when I left, or 25, so many times that I can't even mention. By the time I was 20, I was very, very popular. So I never got hurt. I never spent more than a little bit more than two days. But basically, there were no reason for taking me in, you know, into custody. Just it was just because I had long hair, or I was at a concert, and so every time, you know, they had to let me go. And as a matter of fact, when I was already popular, they knew who I was, and they just wanted to make my life miserable. It was very, very tough times, and you know, some of the years were the darkest pages of Argentina's history were sure. written. I mean, there's 30,000 people that disappear at the hands of the government, and that was one of the main reasons I had to leave in 1978, you know, in the, you know, middle of the junta with Videla and Macera and Agosti. So that's when I left and I came here to California.
And when we listen to your music now, or any of that records that you've produced over the last 20 years or so, if we listen closely, can we hear your experiences from back then? I mean, do those experiences continue to influence how you make music?
I think so. I think those things, you know, really sort of shape who you are and your way of thinking and your way of feeling and your way to the way you approach everything. I mean, the way you approach art itself, the way you approach communicating to people, and feeling that you are, you know, part of this planet, of this world. So obviously, everything that I lived in those days continues to live in me, and actually allow me to have a better perception of the world that I live into. I think they were very instructive, not necessarily for the things that you should do, but also for the things that you shouldn't do.
And what's that like for an artist to have to leave and start again in another country? I mean, are you worried at that point that, wow, you know, what am I going to do in this new... Because I guess it's yeah. different if you're very popular in your country and you decide to, in addition, branch out, but to yeah. have to leave.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I celebrated, because I felt that with the environment that we had in our country, I mean, in which I was... you know, totally, you know, afraid. I mean, we were blacklisted, you know, so we wouldn't get any airplay. I mean, I felt like, you know, in being John Malkovich, you know, that kind of half a floor that has right. a roof, yeah. you know, just, you know, pressing people down. That's how it felt, everything. Wow. I mean, you know, so there were no way that I felt that I could continue my growth in that environment, and I knew I had lots of things to give. I always felt that since I was a little kid, you know. It's not that I envisioned myself as famous or successful, but I always felt that I had something special to share with people, and I could tell that it was not going to happen in that environment. And I felt excited about starting from scratch somewhere else, you know. I felt that I had some important accomplishments already done in Argentina, and it was my time to keep on growing, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, I never cut my liaisons with Argentina. As a matter of fact, even still during military dictatorship, I went back and I did a project. I did a solo record called Santa Eulalia, in which I had to submit the lyrics to the military commission to be approved, and I had, you know, in the songs, in some of the songs, stuff that I knew that it was not going to go through. So I just took those off from the papers that I submit, but I left them in the record because I knew that anyhow they were never going to listen to the record. So, and that's the way, I mean, the record came out with, you know, the lyrics and it just went through, you know. So I, even in the dictatorship, I went back and I worked, but then I went back and I did the Ushuaia La Quiaca, big trip with Leon Gieco through all Argentina, right, recording rural. I was living already here in the States, and I continue my relationship with my country until today. And with Latin America, in a way, I mean, it has even grow bigger not being there. You know, sure, what I mean? It has the fact that I'm here and that I can move around has been very important to develop even a stronger liaison with Argentina and with Latin America. But, you know, there's one song that is really, it's a picture of the time. Remember, this was 1978, and in Argentina we had the World Cup, right? And it was for the first time that color TV was coming to Argentina. Nobody had a color TV, but just, you know, the military government sort of put the equipment to broadcast, but nobody could watch it because nobody had one, you know?
Right.
But we had that. So I actually stay a little longer to finish watching the soccer that we won, the World Soccer Cup, you know? And then came here and wrote a song called Mamá, Amigos, Tengo una TV Color. And it's a letter that a guy writes from Los Angeles saying, you know, hey, mother, friends, I just got a color TV. And with that excuse, he goes on to explain how is life here in the first world and in this super state, you know. And it's pretty acid and critic, you know. But it has a few lines that are kind of tough if I would have left it there, you know.
Let's listen to that. Mamá, amigos, tengo una TV color.
Health food store. Si quieres volver. otra volta el último de Kiss. Bailarines de disco bailan disco en las discotecas. Sábado a la noche se ríe y se duerme a tres. Con Robinson Crusoe en Venus, con un león en una trampa fatal. Con todo lo que vive es oro, y el oro tampoco te tengo. Chequera, tengo telefonado. Si no anda, te lo arreglan antes que lo llames vos. Mamá, 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 amigos, tengo una TV color. Y te piden documentos en la radio, pasan rock and roll.
Let's move on to the, I guess it was late in 80s, early 90s, when the rock and Espanol movement was really in its infancy, and your work with some of the bands. And in particular, I remember hearing an interview here on NPR that you did when you were talking about producing Maldita Vecindad.
Correct.
And you mentioned that you had moved to Mexico and you immersed yourself in
the... Yeah, I didn't move to Mexico, but I started to go there frequently.
And one of the things that really struck me was that you guys recorded the street vendors and how
yes.
they sold their various goods. I mean, what was that like? I mean, what was the idea that you had when you went down there and you wanted to do something? Did you want to do something new?
I tell you what happened. I mean, for many years, I kind of devoted myself to my own project. So first was Arcoiris. Then I had a brief band in Argentina when I was already planning coming to the States. It was called Soluna. Then I had a band here that was like a new wave punk jazz band called Wet Picnic. And then I went to Argentina and I did this trip, this de Ushuaia La Quiaca trip, which, you know, led me to meet with more than, you know, 40 artists around the country that were folk artists that were not interested in making records or right. in being on TV. They would just play because it was a way of life for them. And that really transformed me. I came back here to the States and I said, you know, I'm going to step out of the spotlight. I'm going to put my talent to the service of other people. Because prior to that, the only other artist that I produced, aside of my stuff, was Leon Gieco. And after the Ushuaia La Quiaca and working with so many artists, I came back and I decided to start producing. I went to Mexico just at the same time that all this was happening. I got an invitation to go to Mexico and I saw that scene that was happening there. And it reminded me a lot of when the first movement of Rock Nacional happened in Argentina, the time of Los Gatos, Almendra, Manal, Arcoiris, Vox Day. It really reminded me of that energy. It was a particular moment in Mexico in which PRI split and then got, you know, the PRD and Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas. So it was starting to become a more pluralism of idea. Televisa got TV Azteca now, you know, sort of, you know, competing. The ban on playing rock concerts, which happened after, you know, the massacre in 68, you know, was left. So all these new bands were coming to life. And that's the Insólitas Imágenes de Aurora, who became later Caifanes and later Jaguares. Maldita Vecindad, and very, very there, close to there, Café Tacuba. So I want to be part of this. I want to, you know. And one of the things that really attracted me, which is one of the things that always been part of my motto in every project that I'm involved with, is the concept that is behind identity. You know, I always wanted to do music or art that kind of reflects who you are and where do you come from. And at the time when I did that in Argentina with Arcoiris, I felt a lot of resistance from the intelligentsia of el rock, because they thought that, you know, how can you play a chacarera with an electric guitar? That's not rock, you know, or
right.
how can you use a charango? But these guys, this new Mexican movement, they were embracing everything that had to do with their heritage and their history and transforming into a new language. So I was totally, you know, attracted by it. And I said, you know, I want to be part of this and in anything that I can help making these records, you know, sound the way they should sound. Because I grew up, you know, in Argentina, and it was so tough to, I will hear, you know, American or British bands and I will go, man, I mean, how do they do it? You know, we have the same equipment here, but it's not happening. So once I came to this country, I learned a lot. And now I felt that I could make records that didn't have anything to envy the Anglo records, you know? I mean, you know, you could prefer Jane's Addiction to Maldita Vecindad, or you could prefer Maldita Vecindad to Jane's Addiction. I mean, you know, they were as good bands and as good records. And that was kind of my mission, you know, to make this bands sound, you know, with no different than any of the big American or British bands.
Who was the first Mexican band that you produced?
The first thing that I did was a song that was the only hit that this band had, a band called Neon. Immediately after that, I did Maldita.
Is there which track is your favorite from that album?
Well, from Maldita, I would rather go to what I think is one of the pillars of rock and español, one of the albums that really, for me, marks the history of rock and español, and that's El Circo, you know?
Okay.
So I would say probably, you know, the opener, Pachuco, is a great track.
Oh, I love that song.
Wow, let's listen to that.
We had another question from a listener, Miguel Guerrero. He wanted to know if you would ever produce any Latino artists from the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why that wouldn't happen. I mean, I am now in a phase in my life and in my career in which I have produced more than 100 albums now. And I'm really more concentrated now in Bajo Fondo, in my solo stuff. And, you know, doing music for movies and other things. So I'm not foreseeing myself producing that many acts, you know, outside of these things that I'm involved now. But obviously, I'm always open, and there's no reason why I shouldn't or I couldn't, you know, produce a Latino artist from the U.S. if I find it, you know, interesting and something that I would love to be involved with.
What else did you bring? I know you brought a lot of music that you want to share with us. So
yes, well, since we were talking about this particular moment in time in Mexico, where I think one of the great things about that time period was, you know, the surgeons of this band called Café Tacuba, and it's a group that I've been working now for more than 20 years. I think one of the incredible things about an artist to continue to be relevant is the capacity that the artist has of reinventing itself. And I think these guys have that. I mean, not only the fact that all of them write and that they're amazing, but the fact that they're always really tapping into new territories, and they are totally uninhibited to try anything and without ever losing their identity. I think they're one of the best bands in the world, and I feel very proud to say that as I mentioned before, that I still work with them. I mean, after 20 years, we keep on doing, I believe, great music together. And just, you know, last year, we just did their last album called El Objeto Antes Llamado Disco. And there's a beautiful song from there called De Este Lado del Camino that I think I would love to listen to.
De este lado del camino, sin buscar ningún destino, y aunque el trazo no es muy fino, de este lado del camino, si mi cara está arrugada y mis manos empolvadas, no ha de ser cosa muy rara. Si mi cara está arrugada, he esperado tanto tiempo, tanto, tanto, que ahora que he llegado a mí solo quiero decir que sí. Me
Gustavo, I'm looking at the list of songs that you brought to share with us today, and I'm seeing that there's definitely a theme of journeying and of the road and voyaging. What's up with that?
Well, I mean, it's you know, I think life is like a trip, you know. It's at least the life that we know, I believe, is part of the trip, at least. So I've always been attracted to the road. I have several songs that mention the road and going on the road. I mean, so always traveling and the road have been a big inspiration for me. And I have a couple of things that I'd like to play today that are around this theme. There's this piece, particular piece that I did with the ronroco. The ronroco is this instrument that I did an album that has that name, ronroco, but it's a lower pitch charango, and it's an instrument that I use quite a bit in my scores and in records, in everything that I can. It has become now almost like the guitar for me. The guitar has always been my, you know, my first instrument. I will say now ronroco is there too. And this is a particular piece. It's a thing that I licensed to Louis Vuitton, and they use it for a beautiful film that talks about, you know, the journey of life, and that I had the opportunity to play here in Los Angeles at the Disney Hall with the Philharmonic Orchestra of the Americas, conducted by Alondra de la Parra. So this is live. It's me with the ronroco, and once again, the Philharmonic Orchestra of the America with Alondra de la Parra conducting. Thank you.
That was beautiful. Powerful and beautiful.
It's so vast and lonely. It really does make me think of like a very vast landscape.
It is.
That's beautiful. And
Thank you.
I know you said you started off with the guitar, and now you play so many instruments. What?
Well, I there's a couple of things regarding that. The guitar is my main instrument, and now also is the ronroco. I play some percussion and stuff, but I do play a lot of other instruments that I don't know how to play, and I feel attracted to play instruments that I don't know how to play. As a matter of fact, I mean, one of the biggest examples is the oud, which I use in Babel. That's an instrument that I always wanted to have, you know. It's very, very difficult.
Can you tell us about what that looks like and where?
Yeah, the oud is the ancestor of the lute, therefore the ancestor of the guitar. It's one of the first forms of guitars that we know in the world, and it's a 6-stringed, 5 doubles and 1 single string. Has no frets. The body looks kind of like a lute, so it's kind of like you know, an eggshell, you know, the back of it, you know, and the neck is very short and no frets, so that makes it very, very tough, like a violin. I mean, if you move your finger a little bit to one side, then it's over in terms of tuning. So it's pretty hard to play, but I was looking for something in Babel that I could tie up to the three stories, you know, and it was, you know, in Morocco, in you know, the American-Mexican border, and in Japan. And I found it in this instrument. I didn't want the music of the movie to become like a National Geographic documentary. I wanted to have a world touch, but I wanted to be not precisely from any place. So I play the oud in a different way, in the sense that I don't play it with a pick the way that normally oud players. I play with my fingers. And I played very simple, very minimalistic, because that's all I can play. But that limitation kind of, you know, puts me in a frame of how I should approach. But I love the idea of tapping into instruments that I don't know how to play. It gives me a sense of danger and of innocence. But at the same time, I feel like I'm an artist, and if you give me an instrument, I should be able to do something with it, you know?
It's fascinating to me that you have such great musician chops, but yet you think as a producer, when you're recording your soundtracks or your albums, is there anyone that you looked up to, anyone that you patterned yourself after as a producer, either in Argentina or in this country or anywhere, really?
Well, I would have to say definitely George Martin is a, you know, huge influence. I love, there's other producers that I love, but that work different than George Martin. I will put like George Martin and more contemporary Rick Rubin kind of in the same vein that I work, which is basically trying to connect with what the artist is about and trying to maximize that and trying to find a sound for that artist in particular. Whereas there's other producers that I really like too, people like Brian Eno, which I love, or Daniel Lanois, or, you know, even, you know, further, you know, a long while ago, somebody like Phil Spector.
Sure.
I mean, these people create, they have their own sound. So all the records, no matter who is the artist, they end up somehow, you know, tinted with their sound. And I love it. I like it a lot. But me, I lean towards more the production of George Martin or Rick Rubin, in which each artist actually have, you try to find the sound for that particular artist, you know?
Let's follow that up with some more music.
Okay.
What track do you want to play now?
I love to play Cuca now.
Okay, tell us about it.
Yeah. I love music, you know, world music. I love music from around the world, also since I was a kid. And one particular style of music that I really, really connect with is fado. Fado is a music from Portugal. And it is, you know, very melancholic music, but it has, in that part of melancholism, it connects somehow, you know, in a very direct way with tango. So I can see a relationship between fado and tango. And I love Portugal. I love Lisbon. I love Porto. And when we went to play there for the first time with Bajo Fondo, I wanted to go to a fado house, a house where, you know, they play fado. And I wanted to see this old woman named Argentina Santos. She's like 80-something. And so I called the club, and she said, no, Argentina already played. It was late. So I've called a friend. He said, you should go and check this other place, you know. So I went there, and, you know, fado singers, they just come in and they will say, first of all, one of the things that is common to all of them is that they don't use microphone. They just sing a cappella in the room, you know, with Portuguese guitar, a violão, and usually a double bass, and no amplification. So, and each one comes in and sings three songs, and then another one comes in and sings three songs. And it was, you know, we're having a wonderful time, and then suddenly this girl came on stage, and it was just the times. You know, it stood still. It was, like, amazing. And this girl was Cuca Rosetta. So, you know, I talked to her after, you know, we finished the gig, and I talked to Mario Pacheco, who's a great Portuguese guitar player, and they didn't have an idea who I was and what I've done. So I explained a little bit to them, and I sent them some records afterwards, you know, to say they never got. So it took us, like, a year to actually connect, and finally he was talking to somebody, I guess, at a record label. I said, oh, this guy, Gustavo, you know, he has done this and that, and he won, you know, an Oscars and all this stuff. So they got back to me. We got together, and finally we made a beautiful record. And that record actually made Cuca one of the, you know, strongest figures now in fado in Portugal. I mean, I'm very good friends with Carlo do Carmo and Maritza, which are fantastic fado singers too. But Cuca is really something special, and for me connects me with Amalia Rodriguez, who's, you know, the sure. all-time great fado singer. So this is Cuca singing Came a Tua Final.
Seus olhos brancos deserto.
Gustavo, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. Fue un placer histórico.
Hey, Jasmine, thank you so much, okay? Muchas gracias y a ti también, Félix, y nada, y que hayan dicho esas cosas tan lindas y qué bueno que uno haya podido estar involucrado en tanta música que afecta a la gente positivamente.
Do you think you might stop by again?
Absolutely, anytime. I love it.
Maybe next time we'll do something, you know, like bands that you've been listening to that you're very fond of or something like that, you know?
Music is, you know what I mean? I love it, and I can do this all day, you know?
Gustavo Santaolalla, thank you so much for joining us.
Gracias.
We want to remind our listeners that you can hear all of the music that we play today on our website at npr.org/altlatino.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter.
And Alt Latino Radio at npr.org/music.
I'm Jasmine Garst.
And I'm Felix Contreras.
This has been Alt Latino.